This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
To be Nation listeners, your favorite source of comic book news, the number one and number two entrants on Chris Jericho's list of stupid idiots, yours truly, Greg Phillips, and my cohort, Nick Duke, the hard-traveling fanboys. Nick, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. I feel better about the state of things. I feel like, you know, last week we were able to put some things out there on the table and hopefully put an end to this childish feud between us and the esteemed folks over at the Sellers Point podcast.
That's right. You know, I mean, we're all about being adults here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. You know, we believe in maturity. Mm-hmm. We believe in acting like adults, and we believe in treating comic books the way they should be treated, like serious business. Hey, fatty. So, you know, that now that that's out of the way, we will not need to construct our own list of stupid idiots. So that's good.
But if we were going to construct a list of stupid idiots, I think we all would agree that the no good Noam Dar would be number one on that list.
Oh, the no good rat bastard Noam Dar would be at or near the top of that list, alongside Gotham showrunner Bruno
yes.
Heller.
And on Greg's list, Dr. Pepper commercial character Larry Culpepper.
My God. There is no one right now in America that I want to see strangled more than Larry Culpepper. Even those clown people. I couldn't, you know, if they, Larry, now that's going to be the next problem that's going to sweep our country, is a nation of Larry Culpepper imitators luring children away and threatening them.
Threatening them with ice cold Dr. Pepper here.
Ice cold Dr. Pepper, shut the hell up. Bastard. Anyway, enough of that guy ruining my college football. In any event, we do have an actual show for you here, folks. And this week, we are focusing on Countdown.
And we had to call an audible here on our Countdown. We should probably...
Oh, that's right. I forgot. We carried through on our old tradition of promising things we had no intention of actually delivering.
Now, to be fair, we are still going to deliver on that. We just had to push it back a little bit.
Yes. Originally, we told you all that all 12 or 13 of you that listen to this, we told you all that Marvel honcho Ben Morse was going to be our guest this week, as we were going to count down the top 5 Marvel video games of all time. However, due to a scheduling conflict, we've had to kick that can down the road. That episode will now be coming your way in November. We've already got it scheduled and lined up, and that'll be coming your way as your November countdown. So as a result, what was originally planned to be our November countdown is now our today countdown. And that topic is the top 5 superhero movie fight scenes.
Indeed.
And this will be a list of not comic book movies, but superhero movies, specifically superhero movies.
Right. So something like a scene from Sin City would not be eligible based on our criteria. We do not consider Sin City to be a work of superhero fiction. Now, that's just our opinion. Some might disagree.
And that's a right. You have a right to your opinion, even if it's
exactly
wrong. But before we get to all that, we have to go through our normal rigmarole here at the beginning of the show. I believe that's 2 weeks in a row now I've used the term rigmarole. So I have effectively rigmaroled the audience. Oh, Greg, you slay me. Thanks, Greg. Let's move on. Let's start off with what you're reading and what you're watching.
We should once again point out that we're not watching anything. Greg and I are both hopelessly behind on Fear the Walking Dead. We hope to catch up at some point, I think. But it's, to be honest, it's not overly high on my to-do list. We should mention that this week, as we were recording right now on a Tuesday evening, last night on Monday was the season 3 premiere of Gotham, which of course we won't be talking about here because we don't watch Gotham because
hashtag
Gotham sucks.
Gotham sucks. And we would also like to remind you all that you are listening to the longest running
weekly
episodic
comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history. I think that's the best one we've ever done, by the way.
I think it is. I think that it's damn near
flawless. You caught me in the middle of taking a sip of my ice cold Diet Coke over here, so it was.
Oh, you mean it's not Dr. Pepper?
No, ice cold Dr. Pepper here. No. But if it was, I would hope that 1920s Larry Culpepper would sell it to me.
Oh, Lord. Larry Culpepper and the Jet Sweep on my
shit
list.
Noam Dar.
And the Noam Dar, too. Well, anyway, but before we get to what you're reading, I've got a revelation here. An exclusive. Not even my partner, Nick Duke, knows this. I don't think. Perhaps you've heard of a little video game called Telltale Games Batman.
Oh.
Or Batman, a Telltale Games Adventure, whatever the hell it's called.
Batman, the Telltale series.
Whatever. Anyway, they lied to the buying public, Telltale Games, and never released it when they said they were going to on the PlayStation 3 console, which is what I have. Well, finally, that was remedied this past week.
Oh, really?
And I, Greg Phillips, downloaded the game and have been playing it. I have not yet completed it, episode 1. However, I've been playing it. Quite frankly, I've been enjoying it for the most part. The story is excellent. I will say that it's clear why it took them so long to release it on PS3, because the frame rate is horrible. characters' mouths don't move when they talk sometimes. It's not good graphically.
This is a new engine for them, from what I understand. So they're having they're probably going to be some technical kinks to work out. I just looked it up, and apparently episode 2 is ready for me to play. I didn't even know that. So thank you for saying that. I should be able to go to my machine tomorrow evening, or maybe even tonight after I get out this podcast, and go play a little Batman. So thanks for calling that out.
I do have some first impressions if you'd like to discuss.
Sure. I would like to discuss them as well. You know, I have played episode 1, although it's been a little bit.
No plot spoilers.
Okay. Which,
because I have not.
Oh, you haven't finished it yet. Okay, all right.
No. I have not finished it yet. I have gotten up until a point in which Batman has recently discovered a crime scene where a bunch of people were massacred, and he is going after the person he believes responsible for the massacre.
Okay.
Or about to go after them. But other than the PS3 graphics issue, like I said, it especially at the beginning, the very beginning, was almost unplayable. The sequence where you have a rooftop battle with a certain female.
Greg, that's character. All out in production still. I think you can say that Catwoman's in the game.
Catwoman. Yeah, you have a rooftop battle with Catwoman. That scene was almost unplayable for me.
And that sucks, man, because it was really smooth on PS4, like, to the point where it was so the QuickTime events were so synced up with what was going on screen that it almost felt unnatural at first. I'm used to there being that brief delay between, like, something happens on screen and then you get the button press, but it was almost encouraging you to be in the flow of the actual fight that was going on. So that's disappointing to hear that you're not getting the same experience the next gen guys are getting.
Right, exactly. But I will say that the actual, like, dialogue and the exchange was awesome. And I think the biggest takeaway from this so far is I absolutely love, so far, from what I've seen, this version of Selina Kyle.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
They are killing it with her. Her interaction with Bruce.
I'm trying to remember where the scene that you said you got up to takes place in the game. I will say that you have an interaction with Selina out of the Batman costume later.
Yep. Yeah, I've already done that. Yep,
at the cafe or whatever.
Shop.
And that, I think that's my favorite moment of the entire first episode.
Easily. Yes, easily the best part of the whole episode because there's so much going on. Both of them are trying to
see. Now I want to discuss plot spoilers because I want to know how you handled it. Because I know I played it a certain way, and if I had to bet, I think I know how you played it, and you probably played it the same way I did because of our shared affinity for the Bruce and Selena relationship.
Yes, yes, I would bet that we did as well. I helped her out. And tried to, and I was as nice to her as I could possibly be.
Did you trust her with certain information?
She kind of
yeah,
knew.
Exactly. But there was a way that you could kind of cop to it, or you could try and like obfuscate, you know?
Yeah. I kind of copped to it. Yeah. So. No, I played. I'm interested to play through again, actually, and go as more of like a hardline
Bruce.
Like hard ass.
What's really cool about this is you could really play your Bruce and your Batman as two separate characters. Like you can play
Are you doing that? Because I'm doing a Bruce Wayne who is publicly corrupt, and I'm doing a Batman who is like, because my theory is as Bruce I'm trying to glad hand Carmine Falcone and get on his good side, and as Batman I'm attacking him more physically. So I figure I'm fighting the war on two fronts.
I think I'm doing my Bruce as kind of like an animated series version of Bruce, where he puts off this very almost aloof front in public. So that's the way I'm playing him. And then Batman, I am playing, you know, pretty much as straight up hard ass, you know, brutal Batman. I will say that the few scenes I've had where you control Bruce and he's not in front of large groups of people, like when he has the one-on-one meeting with Falcone and when he's having private conversations with Harvey Dent, I drop the aloof thing for that, because I really view the aloof Bruce as more of a, you know, for public situations only type of character.
Yeah. See, so in this playthrough, I'm actually doing it where Bruce is trying to make people think that he is in line with Falcone. I don't know if that's going to actually play a factor later on or not, or if it's going to be one of those, you know, decisions that don't really have any impact. But I also completely shut out Vicky Vale because of my love of the Bruce and Selena relationship. So.
Right. I think there's a moment where you have to choose whether you want to share information with Vicky Vale or with Jim Gordon, and I'm like, well, that's the easiest decision in the history of decisions.
Yes, same here. Same here. But no, I'm enjoying it. I mean, I can't wait to play it when we get done with this, actually, because I'm very much enjoying it and looking forward to seeing how episode one ends.
I don't think you have that much left, to be honest. You may only have like one or two more scenes.
I don't think I do, because I was playing it for a pretty long time last
night. That's what I'm saying. I think you're almost done with the first episode. If you've gotten to the cafe scene, you should be getting close to wrapping that first episode up. So,
mm-hmm. And I will say it. I'm not completely anti this version of Oswald Cobblepot.
Oh wow!
But
I'm stunned by that.
It does bother me a little bit that it's taking elements from a character I like much more. And I'm also never a fan of Cobblepot as an actual physical threat. But in this case, you know, I like the scene where they introduced him, and I'm willing to use the old wrestling expression, I'm going to let it play out and see where it goes.
See where it goes, yep. So anyway, moving on.
Mm-hmm. Moving on. Let's go to what you're reading. And this week, I once again read four comic books. Yes, only four comic books. But that's enough to create a top three and enough to create a bottom one. And for the first time in a while, I am very, very comfortable coming up with bottom one. Let's save bottom one for last. Let's start us off at our number three position. Nick, why don't you get us started?
Fine, fair enough. At my number three position, I have The Adjectiveless Spider-Man, number 8. This is another Civil War II tie-in. This is probably the most heavily involved that Miles has been in the actual Civil War II event thus far. And I gotta say, I really enjoyed it. You kind of see the events of, you know, what happened to Bruce Banner in Civil War II play out from Miles' perspective, and it's very interesting. You also have standout cameos from Jessica Jones and Luke Cage, who are almost trying to take on some sort of a mentor-like role for Miles and trying to show him where he's failing as Spider-Man and where he could be doing better, and kind of give him a little bit of a pep talk. So very much enjoyed this issue. I've only read, I think, 4 tie-in issues of Civil War II, but I can say comfortably that the tie-ins to this point that I've read have been much better than the main series. So see if that continues as we wrap up the story out through the end of the year.
Do you find that they are doing a good job of integrating Miles Morales into the greater Marvel universe?
So far, yeah. I mean, he's been an Avenger, which I haven't read any of the Avengers series, he's been an all-new, all-different Avenger. Forgive me for not adding that that nomenclature to the beginning.
Well, that's the only way you can know what book you're talking about, is if you call
it all-new, all-different Avengers. So, yeah, he's been featured heavily. So, yeah, it seems like they're doing a pretty good job, and he's going to be a member of that Champions team that they're putting a big push behind as well. He's playing a key role. You can't really ask for much more than that. So I've been pleased thus far. I think the continuity nerd in me is still trying to figure out exactly what the continuity implications are of him being moved over to the 616 universe in terms of what events in his past still happened and how, like, the memories of his supporting cast have been affected. Like, is he the only one that's aware that they used to live in a different universe? I mean, how exactly did the Molecule Man put it all back together for him? So,
now the Molecule Man, is he at all anything like Moleculo?
Sadly, no. No, Miles gave him a cheeseburger, and so because he gave him a cheeseburger, he brought his mom back to life. That's a true story, by the way.
Well, that's a lot different than the origins of Molecula.
The
Molecula Man!
C2S Moleculo.
El Hombre de los Moleculos.
We've gone off the rails again. Anyway, moving on to your number 3.
All right. Hey, my number three is a book that had the best cover of the 4 books that I read this past week. Action Comics 962. This was the conclusion of the Doomsday arc that had been carrying on since the beginning of the Action Comics renumbering at the beginning of Rebirth. And this is by Dan Jurgens and Steven Segovia. And another good issue in this. Action has been very consistent since the beginning of Rebirth. A very fun action title. An incredible cover to this one, with Doomsday fighting Superman through a giant Action Comics logo that's, like, been turned to rubble. Really cool. But yeah, this is basically a wrap-up of the Doomsday arc. Gives us a little bit more information about Ozymandias, I should say, or who we believe to be Ozymandias. Mr. Oz,
yes.
As he gains possession of Doomsday at the end of the issue. And along the way, we see a little bit more from Lex interacting with Superman. We see Wonder Woman get involved again. Just another action-packed issue appropriate for this title. Dan Jurgens continues to deliver strong characterizations. A Superman I recognize, a Lois I recognize, and a Doomsday that I recognize. I put this on Twitter. I'm so happy to see Doomsday treated properly, because frankly I don't think he's been handled properly in 25 years.
You mean to tell me you didn't like the Doomed storyline from the New 52?
Again, I didn't read the book, but I did not like the premise. I did not like the premise, I can tell you that much.
Fair enough.
I've heard people like the story, and that's great, but to me it's a character and name only kind of situation. Overthinking the character of Doomsday. But I digress. That's my number 3 book. Your number 2?
My number 2 book of the week, I'm going to go back to the Marvel side of the ledger, and it's going to be Old Man Logan number 11. This book, I'm pretty sure, has been on my top 3 every time it's come out. Continues to be just amazing, even though I will say this is probably the story arc of the 3 they've done that I'm the least invested in thus far. But still, very good. I mean, the Sorrentino art has been amazing. I continue to love how they are telling the story almost in a Thor God of Thunder type way in parallel, where you get future events that are actually, to Old Man Logan anyway, past events, because, you know, he's an old man, and so he remembers the aftermath of the villain uprising. And so we see flash forward slash flashbacks, and then we also see present day and how the two stories are tied together. And so the whole theme of the series as far has been Logan trying to prevent the future from, you know, happening the way it does in his timeline. And so it's cool to see how the events that he is seeing in our current timeline parallel those that happened to him and how they are affecting him emotionally. So cool stuff here. You know, interested to see where the storyline goes from here. I will say, however, reading some of the Marvel solicits for November and December, I am a little concerned because Sorrentino, I know in December, is listed as a cover artist only for this title, not for interiors. So that has me a little concerned, but I will withhold judgment until we get some January solicits. Maybe it's a temporary thing.
Hopefully so. Even the greats need a break once in a while.
Absolutely.
My number two from this stack of comics that I'm still not even close to finished with is Deathstroke Rebirth, number one, if you want to call it that. I know you weren't as high on this. I really liked it. I thought it was very, very entertaining, very well put together. This is by Christopher Priest, just credited as Priest in the book. And who is the artist? I'm trying to determine that right now and having no luck whatsoever.
His name's on the front of the book.
Well, I know his last name, but I don't want to just say Pagulayan. I don't even know how to pronounce it. In any event, he's good. The art is very, very good. The writing is good. The characterizations are interesting. I love the construction of the story, how you see flashbacks to Slade's time as a father. The artist, by the way, is Carlo Pagula. His first name's Carlo. I can say that. And also good colors in this issue. Jeremy Cox is the colorist. Does a great job. I enjoyed seeing Cox. Slade's time as a father and how some of his past actions still haunt him to this day. And he's thinking back to being really harsh and abusive towards his kids and dismissive. And there's a scene in here in particular when it's clear that he almost holds a grudge against himself for what may have happened back in those days. And it also introduces us to Old Man Clock King, which is kind of cool. And it also introduces us to Old Man Wintergreen, who I can't help but read as Red Foreman from That 70s Show, because his last line in the book is Slade finds him in this little cubbyhole that he's been held captive in a cave. He says, "Wintergreen," and then Wintergreen turns around and says, "Well, it's about bloody time, jackass."
I will have you know, as a That 70s Show aficionado, Red's preferred derogatory term was dumbass, not jackass.
Well, jackass, dumbass, who gives a... Well, you know. In any event, I like Deathstroke Rebirth. I'm interested. I have the first issue as well, so I'm interested in following this to fruition. Fruition.
And let's not forget that the actor who played Red Foreman also played one Clarence Boddicker.
Clarence Boddicker.
In RoboCop.
Yes. That is... correct. That's right.
I just wanted to say that. I didn't really have any.
No, didn't have anything to follow with.
Had no bearing on anything like that. You know.
Well, thanks for your contributions, Francis.
You're welcome, Clarence.
Quite frankly.
In any event, moving on to my number one book of the week.
Number one
is Detective Comics number 940. I absolutely loved this issue. This wraps up the initial storyline for this title. It is very much focused on Tim Drake and the choice he is making in this book to face down the drone army. As we referenced last week when Greg was giving his thoughts on 939. But we also get some really cool moments where Kate Kane, you know, has a big showdown with her dad and kind of makes the decision that she's done with him. And so that's kind of a cool emotional moment. But then, to me, the scene of the book is Batman goes to console Spoiler about Tim's apparent demise, and she shows him one of Tim's possessions something that meant a lot to Tim, and Batman sees it. And the artist, you actually see him draw the tremble in Batman's hand and as he drops it. And then, like, in another sign, as we talked about, of a somewhat softer take on Bruce, he actually embraces Spoiler. And the last image you see of those two characters in this title are them embracing each other and tears streaming down each of their faces. So, really, really cool scene that I enjoyed very much. I will also say, I like how they are tying titles together in this big Rebirth story, carrying on the threads from DC Universe Rebirth that you wouldn't necessarily expect. For example, as you referenced earlier, you know, the appearance of Mr. Oz in Action Comics. He makes an appearance here at the end of Detective Comics as well, implying that Tim Drake is somehow key to whatever his plan is. So,
Tim Drake and Doomsday.
Yeah, really. But, and they're also empty holding cells to imply that there are going to be other characters joining them there. So, I don't know what that's all about just yet, but I am interested to find out. So, yeah, Detective Comics 940, my number one book of the week.
Let me ask you this while we're on topic. It sounds like an awesome issue. I'm sure it's a great issue, and I'm going to love it because I've loved pretty much all the issues leading up to this. Do you feel at all that the Batman books have gone to this well too often of Batman grieving for a Robin or for a supporting character who is seemingly killed or maimed?
I don't think so. I mean, I know it's happened, but I mean, you have to, especially when you're dealing with non-powered characters, there have to be real physical stakes. You can't feel like characters are constantly escaping from impossible situations, you know, mostly unscathed. I like this, and I like it because they also do not put the audience through the false exercise of trying to convince the reader that Tim's death is legitimate. They tell you up front, he is still alive, this is what's going on with him. It is only the characters within that universe that are not aware of his survival. So we have more information than Batman does at this point.
Right, but I would ask you, how does that differ significantly from what happened at the end of Forever Evil with Dick Grayson, where Batman and the audience knew that Dick was still alive, but everyone in the supporting family thought he was dead, and essentially didn't really seem to care that much.
It differs in that Batman doesn't know, and that's the big thing here, is that Bruce doesn't have that self-satisfaction of him pulling the wool over people's eyes for what he deems to be, you know, ultimately good intentions. And so because you don't have that, you still have Bruce with this a renewed sense of guilt that might counteract some of that positivity we've seen from him since his return. So I think it will serve as a reminder to Bruce that just because things have gone relatively well for him since the events of Endgame does not mean that things are always going to go well for him. So I don't have an issue
with
it.
No, I got it. I'm open to it because I'm enjoying the book, but I do think that they've gone to that well too frequently in recent years, because it's kind of like that desensitive. I'm trying to think of the way to pronounce this.
Desensitivity?
I have become desensitized to the mourning in the Bat family because Damian died in, what, 2012 or 13, something like that. Dick Grayson, quote, died at the end of Forever Evil in, what, 14, I think, or 15?
Something like that.
And now Tim. And it wasn't terribly long before Damian that Stephanie had died in the time of War Games. And it's like, at
a
certain
War
point,
Games was a good bit before Damian's death.
2005, 2006, but then you're talking about 2012. Yeah, that is a pretty good while.
7 years is a long time in superhero comics.
True, but then again, I can't remember too many characters that have had that many side characters get important supporting characters seemingly get killed in that time frame. In fact, I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Well, but that stands to reason because Batman is the preeminent street-level, non-powered hero. And so
it would be like Daredevil killing off Foggy Nelson and then killing off, like, 2 years later, I don't know. Who else are Daredevil supporting characters? I don't even know. I just know Foggy Nelson, basically. Ben Urich.
Karen Page.
Karen Page, who's already been dead for many, many, many years. But, you know, I'm kind of – it takes away the emotional impact for me because it's like old hat at this point. You go through the cycle. He mourns it. He's sad. He's upset. He gets over it. Then the person comes back and they're happy.
Yes, but the difference here is that – all right, so Batman has these years of experience, but how is this going to affect the rest of the team? Spoiler doesn't have this experience.
True.
This is a right. version of Spoiler that does not remember any sort of costume career before the events of Batman Eternal. This is a version of Cassandra Cain that Tim Drake is one of the few people she's formed a true emotional bond with. This is a version of Batwoman who has been tasked by Batman with training these kids, and she feels like she has failed in some fashion. So the impact right. of this doesn't just play out through Bruce's eyes, who has had these experiences. It plays out through the eyes of characters who have not had these experiences.
Absolutely. No, I agree. I agree that the book is probably going to pull it off well. It's probably going to be written well. It's just I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, okay, come up with some new ideas, Batman writers. But that's just me. Now, I'm sure the book's going to be awesome, and I'll give it a glowing review whenever I get around to reading it in a few weeks, hopefully. Hopefully sooner than that. But, the book continues to rock. Detective is the best of the Batman books in both of our opinions, I think. And looking forward to it continuing to rock going forward. My number one book of the period that I read is Action Comics 961, the issue that came immediately prior to the final issue of the story arc. This is pretty much the climax of the big battle between Superman and Doomsday. Again, Dan Jurgens and Steven Segovia doing great work in this one. You get to see a little bit more from Lex in this one. You see a brief appearance from Superwoman, but the bulk of the story is the knockdown, drag-out fight Doomsday versus Wonder Woman and Superman. Superman telling Wonder Woman to go protect his family. Just great Superman moments that reminded me of when I was a kid reading The Death of Superman and how noble and selfless and courageous his fight was against Doomsday. You also see John Kent for the first time really unleash his heat vision on a villain, in this case on Doomsday. And actually seems to hurt Doomsday briefly until Doomsday shrugs it off and goes Brock on everything. But just another action-packed issue that has great character moments between Superman and Wonder Woman, and especially between Lois and Clark, that are really well rendered, really classical, and very reverent towards the original Death of Superman story. Particularly the scene where they kiss each other, it looks almost exactly like the scene where Clark and Lois kiss on the helicopter before he flies down to have his big final battle against Doomsday. So, really good issue. One of my favorites of this title yet, actually, since the Rebirth Initiative. That's my number one.
All right.
And that does it with – no, it doesn't do it. That does it with our top three. Now let's go to our bottom one. Nicholas, your bottom one.
This is a tough one because this was a week where I enjoyed every book that I picked up this week to at least some extent. But if I got to pick a bottom one this week, I'm going to go with Action Comics 963. The first issue of the Superman Meet Clark Kent storyline. No, I don't really have many complaints with this book, and I guess the only reason it lands on my bottom list is, as you and I have discussed, one of the great things about Action Comics is it has felt like an action comic. This still has some action in it, but they obviously, from a Doomsday storyline, they have to dial it back a lot. And so to go from that frenetic 90-mile-an-hour pace to a more 55-mile-an-hour pace, you know, something more around the normal average speed limit, it feels like a massive slowdown, which feels a little out of place for a title that hasn't – we've only known it as, you know, go, go, go since its inception.
Yeah, so.
And to be honest, I'm really not that interested in the idea of imposter Clark Kent who doesn't have any memory of being Superman. That just isn't – like, I'm much more interested in Lex and Superman interacting than I am in this version of Clark and Superman interacting. And this book is told almost entirely from this Clark Kent's point of view. So I still enjoyed the read. It just, I don't know.
I'm mainly interested in figuring out what the gimmick is, what the deal is with the Clark Kent that's running around. Right. But no, that's interesting. And as usual, you know, we often have this problem where there's a bottom book that really isn't a bad book at all. We just put it on there because it's, you know, that's just how it falls in our pecking order that given week. In this case, for me, it was easy to pick a worst book of my reading experience this past week, because this one was how to describe it. I'm not going to say it's a horrible comic, because it's not. I'm going to say that it is certainly not a good comic. I wouldn't even say it's an average comic. I would say this is a below average comic book, and I don't think there's any reason for it to be below average. And that would be Justice League number 2. Now, I know there have been at least one, probably two issues of this that have come out since this issue came out. But honestly, this does not make me want to continue reading this. And it's off my pull list by this point. But, Nick, I just don't know how you can write a boring Justice League story, but that's what this is.
I don't know either, because if you haven't read any of Hitch's Justice or JLA,
I read the first issue.
His JLA is not boring at all. And it's amazing because he's telling a very decompressed story, but he's finding a way to keep it interesting along the way. This feels like a more compressed story, but at the same time, mm-hmm. a much more boring story. Like, all the characters kind of read the same to a certain extent. Like, yeah. It's very generic and bland is the best way I can describe it.
Does it not feel like we've seen – maybe I'm imagining things. I swear I feel like I've either read or watched this story before.
I have no idea.
It seems so – maybe not exactly the story, but maybe it seems so reminiscent of every Justice League versus Alien Invasion story I've ever read. Like, whether it be the pilot episode of Justice League.
To be fair, that's Hitch's one. That's his one.
That's his one, for God's sake. That and the shot of even the artists that are drawing the book, Tony Daniel, the shot of the multiple ships flying overhead that we saw all the way back in The Authority and in The Ultimates. And in this issue of Justice League, the first page, Simon Baz has green blimps just filling the sky heading into the distance. And it's like, okay, I understand you have things you like to do, but my God, man, do something original. This is such an unoriginal, uncreative story. Like, you know, it seems like the Justice League should be the easiest, most exciting book to write. But like, to your point, Nick, the only character in this whole thing that feels like she's written differently from the others is Jessica Cruz.
I would argue Wonder Woman to a certain extent as well.
And Wonder Woman to an extent. Both of the female characters feel like they're written differently. But Batman, The Flash,
Aquaman, Cyborg, Superman, all mostly the same. Yep.
Aquaman is written like the blandest, corniest Silver Age character you can imagine.
He's written like what people who make fun of Aquaman imagine Aquaman to be.
Yes. Yep. Like, he's riding on his noble seahorse and talking with ellipses between everything he says. And
concentric circles are coming out of his forehead.
The way that they write his dialogue sometimes, it feels like he's cutting a Triple H promo. Where he's like, must clutch crystals to stay alive. It just goes on like that forever, and I don't know, man. I'm really disappointed because Justice League should be a flagship title, and you know, I'm enjoying how he writes Jessica Cruz, but other than that, I'm just so bored by all of this. It's just been there and done that, and in an initiative that is filled with stories that feel fresh and new, even if they're doing old stories, it feels like they're updates of old stories. This just feels like same old, same old.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It was, yeah. I think I've read up through 4, and I'm done. I can't do anymore. It's just not worth the investment.
No, not with competition being what it is. But with all that said, that brings us to an end, a merciful end to reading and watching. And hopefully next week I'll have read more and gotten closer to catching up. In the meantime, we're going to get to our news and notes segment, The Rundown, where we've got three items to talk with you about from around the world of comics. Nick, you want to get us started here?
Yeah, I mean, I can. Where do we want to start? Let's see. How about let's start with a little bit of negative news. Let's start with something that came out this past week involving a Marvel Cinematic Universe entry that we will be discussing down the road in Hard Travelers for Hire.
Quite a while down the road.
Yeah, we're going to push that one down the road. But this is a story that came out involving the production of Iron Man 3. Those of you who may remember the character of Maya Hansen from that movie, played by actress Rebecca Hall, who also was notably in Chris Nolan's The Prestige. That's probably where you remember her best from, if you don't remember her from Iron Man 3. She basically said in an interview this past week that the role she wound up playing in Iron Man 3 was far different than the role she signed on to play, and that the reason was because Marvel Studios wanted her role diminished due to concerns about toy sales. And one thing you have to have a little context here, there is nothing that Greg Phillips and I hate more than creative decisions for television and film properties being made based on toy sales.
If you've ever seen the meme online of the angry baby holding up the fist, that's Nick and I whenever we hear people bring up toy sales as a driving reason behind any creative decision.
Presumably, from what we've been led to believe, toy sales are responsible for us no longer having Green Lantern the Animated Series and Young Justice. So,
yep.
Toy sales can go fuck themselves.
The abstract concept of toy sales can go fuck themselves.
Right. That's exactly. I said it, and I stand by it. So, yeah, anyway, I know you're... I don't want to give away too much too soon, but I know you're a little higher on Iron Man 3 than I am.
I am very high on
your thoughts on this piece of news.
Well, before I get to that, I wanted to get to the other thing that she revealed in the interview, which is, and I agree with this criticism. She said that she was very upset that the film at no point had anyone wrestling for an hour. And I happen to share that sentiment with all the Iron Man movies, or Iron Man movies, if you will, and wish they could have been filmed differently for that reason. But onto the serious matter at hand, what she said actually backs up what the director, Shane Black, has said about the studio interference in the movie in terms of essentially changing the story from what her role was originally supposed to be and reducing it because they did not think that a female action figure would sell for the movie. And I don't even know where to go with this, Nick. I mean, that is an asinine statement if I've ever heard one from – especially from a studio that seems to get so much goodwill for anything.
And deservedly
they do. Their movies are incredible. Iron Man 3 is a great movie. I'm a huge fan of it. And, quite frankly, I'd suggest that critics and audiences everywhere agreed with me, quite frankly, except for a vocal minority. But in any event, regardless of how much one likes it or doesn't like it, it is considered by most to be a good movie.
Yeah, I would go that far, yeah, sure.
And to me, it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But again, this is just so unnecessary and stupid. And the fact that they reduced her role in favor of what was a pretty crappy villain, quite honestly.
But that's one thing that we can say about the Marvel Cinematic Universe is bland, somewhat uninteresting villains seem to be par for the course, with the exception...
And let's be honest, bland, somewhat uninteresting male villains.
Yeah, I mean, with the exception of Loki and Ultron, who you and I are much higher on Ultron than a lot of people are, I can't really think of a great
Marvel villain
in the movies, anyway.
Zemo.
Zemo is pretty good, yeah. I'll give you that.
But yeah, no, you're that's exactly right. And so it just kills me because, okay, we would rather have an uninteresting male villain than any female villain. So that pisses me off and bothers me. And she also brings up in this interview how slow Marvel has been to latch on to a female superhero, to do a female superhero film. The fact that we still don't have a Black Widow movie is ridiculous. Yes, we're getting Captain Marvel finally, but I'm sorry, there's really no excuse for being this far into the Marvel Cinematic Universe and not getting a female-led superhero movie. So I think this speaks to a bigger issue, not necessarily with Marvel, with Hollywood as a whole. I think it speaks to some of the stupid ideas that are still taking shape within some of the people that are making decisions at these studios. And we see it at Warner Brothers in some capacities. We see it at Marvel Studios in other capacities. And, of course, we see it at all the other major film studios. So here's hoping that things change, that this new lineup of Marvel movies take more chances and are freer from studio interference, and we get to see a little more chances taken in the MCU.
Speaking specifically from a female standpoint, you know, we do have Captain Marvel coming up. The Ant-Man sequel, the Wasp has been bumped up essentially to a co-lead. She's in the title of the movie. It's going to be called Ant-Man and the Wasp. We have Wonder Woman coming out on the DC side. And in this brilliantly placed segue, you've got, from what we've been led to believe anyway, a standalone Harley Quinn spinoff is officially moving forward over at Warner Brothers. Greg, tell us a little bit about this one.
Yes, Harley Quinn, one of the breakout stars of the maligned by us and critics, but
like
loved by some. by some and by many, apparently, Suicide Squad film. She, according to sources, is going to get her own spinoff film that will have, pardon me, that will have other characters in it from the DC universe, other DC heroines specifically, and it's part of a big contract that Margot Robbie just signed with Warner Brothers. And speaking only for myself, I am perfectly fine with all the Margot Robbie movies that Warner Brothers wants to put out.
I too will allow it.
And in all seriousness, I think there's a lot of potential. Harley Quinn right now, I think you would agree with this, Nick, is probably DC's hottest property.
Strangely enough, yeah. I never thought we'd see the day where she, I mean, she, as we'll discuss in a few minutes, she was the number one selling book, her solo title. And so, strike while the iron is hot, man. Why not now? Go for it.
That's right.
I think they need to bring in, I'm hoping it winds up being Harley and the Birds of Prey, or Harley and maybe even a Gotham City Sirens movie with Harley and Poison Ivy and Catwoman, or something. I just don't know that as a movie, a standalone Harley movie by herself will work. I have some concerns about that.
Let me tell you, I disagree with you, and let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. I hope that they don't overload this movie with other DC characters.
I didn't say overload. I said add.
I think there is plenty of story potential to be mined out of Harley if they explore her character to its full potential in terms of Harley, who is trying to deal with what the Joker has done to her, while simultaneously trying to get over the Joker and trying to go about living her own life while getting in hijinks along the way.
But based on the ending of Suicide Squad, you would think that at the beginning of this movie, she and the Joker would still be together.
Precisely. That's why I think there's a lot of story potential to be mined there. The movie doesn't need to be Joker and Harley Quinn going around and, I don't know, being happy. The movie needs to be it needs to fix where Suicide Squad screwed
and
up.
And I guess that's the difference between you and I, is I think you have more faith in them to actually fix that than I do.
I do, because they did film scenes, apparently, where the Joker was abusive towards her. They just chose not to put that in the movie because they're idiots. Which, I guess, fits your point of why have faith in idiots to do something right. But in this case, I think that they will get it right. I think that they will have the right people calling the shots to come in and say, okay, here is why Harley Quinn is popular, here is why people identify with her, and here is why she's a great character. Now let's tell that. I think the mistake is to do a Harley Quinn movie but not think she's a strong enough character to carry her own movie. I think that's a mistake, personally. But we'll see. I mean, that's just one man's opinion from under the black Resistol hat.
Indeed. Indeed it is.
But let's go to our final rundown. Actually, that was our final rundown item,
wasn't
it?
No, it wasn't.
What else do we... Oh, that's right. Our final rundown item is the big rundown item.
Folks, you can tell, as always, Greg is overwhelmingly prepared for tonight's podcast.
Well, no, you mixed up the order on me. We had an order, and you got off the order. Quite frankly, but that's neither here nor there. We had this lined up in a very detailed and regimented Facebook chat, and Nick's decided to go off format. He's shooting, folks. No, our biggest story of the week: August sales estimates and comparisons. In this case, the biggest selling month of comics in, what, 20 years, Nick, I believe?
Man, you stretched that out. You're on the Triple H promo kick tonight, huh?
I am. I've been watching a lot of 2003 Monday Night Raw because I like to punish myself frequently. So,
but yes, to get back to what Greg was saying, basically this was the largest number of comic books shipped in a single month since December of 1996. So almost 20 years.
10.26 million comic books shipped to North American comics retailers in August. That is a phenomenal number.
For the entire industry. Yeah. I mean, that's good for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. More people walking through the doors helps everybody out. But I think you and I would tend to agree that it does our old fanboy hearts good to see that a certain secret society of comic publishers, we don't think we have to say their name here, reaped the benefits.
That's right, because what we saw was DC's – we mentioned last month, actually, right here on this show, that DC for the first time in like 36 months had surpassed Marvel in the market share, which seemed impossible just a year ago.
Right.
Well, instead of evening out again in the month of August when a lot of the Rebirth launches had already happened, what we saw this past month was market share, the DC market share actually increased over Marvel this past
year. Yes, and I would venture a guess. This is just pure speculation on my part. I think that's due to a combination of factors. I think it's a combination of DC successfully staggering their Rebirth rollouts to where you still had some Rebirth titles releasing in August, some number ones that were out there, and the overwhelmingly positive critical response and fan response to Rebirth, paired with the relatively tepid, lukewarm response that Civil War II and its related tie-in issues have received thus far. So you have DC in the midst of this ultra-successful initiative, and Marvel tied up in one of their giant crossover events they do so often, but this one isn't going over well, and so it's a perfect storm of factors for this. What I am most interested to see is not even the September numbers. I want to see the October numbers when they come in, because you will have Marvel doing its latest relaunch with several titles that they're putting big promotion behind, including The Clone Conspiracy, including Champions, including Jessica Jones. I believe there'll be a new Avengers book on the stands as well. Riri Williams as Ironheart in Invincible Iron Man. You'll have a lot going on from Marvel. DC will have, at that point, rolled out all of its number one titles and will be, in some cases, up to, like, issues 10 or 11 of some books. And so I am interested to see what the final numbers come out, you know, in October. If it comes out and DC is close or even ahead by some stretch of the imagination, I think it would set up DC very well to go on a run of dominance, quite frankly. From a sales perspective,
a Bill Goldberg-like run of dominance?
I don't know that it would be Bill Goldberg-like, you know, mainly because it would actually be happening rather than just numbers being arbitrarily added to a stat sheet.
Now, wait a minute. What are you implying here? This is we're not going to live in the dirt here.
I am implying that I find it a bit hard to believe that Bill Goldberg wrestled 35 times in 3 days. I just don't. I don't find it. It's difficult for me to believe.
Well, quite frankly, perhaps with that attitude, that's why.
That's why event, what?
That's why you can't believe it. You choose not to believe it. By you not believing in Goldberg, I feel like that's why, you know, it's your already inherent lack of belief in Goldberg contributes to you not being able to believe that he could wrestle 35 times in 3 days.
Just saying.
Has he not wrestled Jerry Flynn enough?
Well, at a certain point, Jerry Flynn would have to stop wrestling and go to the hospital. I mean, like, you know, there's only so many times you can wrestle Jerry Flynn or you know, or Hugh Morris or somebody like that, you know?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a fair point, but, you know, he had the whole Dungeon of Doom to go through, but that's another story.
Was the Dungeon of Doom still even a thing in 1997?
Believe it or not, yes. Yes, but they were kind of only an ancillary thing because all of the important Dungeon of Doom members, mainly Conan and the Giant, went to the NWO. So that left you with a Dungeon of Doom consisting of Hugh Morris, Ming, and the Barbarian.
Mm. No Taskmaster, huh?
And the Taskmaster, of course. But Taskmaster was feuding with...
Anyway, moving on. Back to comic books.
Anyway, so some of the numbers here. Overall comic unit sales up 43% from a year ago, up 51% from 5 years ago, and up 27% from 10 years ago this month. Just incredible numbers, really.
Ooh, look at that. Look at that 15 years ago number.
15 years ago, 57% up.
Not what I'm seeing.
Top 300. Oh, that's right. Yep. I have found the wrong number. Yeah, I'm looking at the top 300 comics unit sales.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the dollar sales. My mistake.
Yeah. Up 57% from 15 years ago. Just incredible numbers across the board. Harley Quinn being the standout, and I've pulled up the Comicron numbers here. Harley Quinn shipped just under 400,000 copies last month, highly impressive numbers. Let's round out our top 10 here. Top 10 titles according to Comicron, which is based on Diamond Distributors for the month of August.
And we should preface this with the top 10, 9 DC books.
Yes, 9 DC books in the top 10. Here we go. We're going to start at number 10 because Nick is a slave to the reverse format. So at number 10, we've got Supergirl Rebirth. It's at 112,000 copies.
That's
sorry.
Stunning to me.
Harley Quinn number 2 at number 9 at 116,000 copies. Justice League number 2 at 127,000. Lord almighty, so many people buying that bad book. Or average, below average, what I'll say. At number 6 and 7 are Batman 4 and 5, respectively, and they're both north of 140,000 copies. Suicide Squad Rebirth number 1 at number 5 with 177,000 copies. Amazing Spider-Man number 16, the only Marvel book in the top 13, in the top 15. My God, only one of only two Marvel books in the top 20. Wow.
What was the other, out of curiosity?
Star Wars 22, okay, yeah, at number sense. 20.
Star Wars books are still selling great, are doing, you know, great business for Marvel.
Yeah, it was a number 20 at 85,000. Amazing Spider-Man moved 185,000 copies. That's number 16 of that. Then you got Suicide Squad number 1.
Which outsold the Rebirth.
Outsold the Rebirth.
Which is interesting.
217,672 copies. All-Star Batman number 1, 289,000. And, of course, Harley Quinn, number one at number one.
Right, and you said that sold 400,000 copies?
Just under 400,000.
So it outsold a Scott Snyder Batman number one issue that had been hyped to high heaven. It outsold it by 100,000 copies.
That's correct.
That is bewildering to me. Like, I have read some of the Harley Quinn title, and I like what I've read. But this thing is reaching an audience that, like, I do not understand or comprehend, but I'm glad it's out there.
Absolutely, and I think that it's illustrating a few things. I think it's illustrating that there is a female readership out there that a lot of people like us didn't think was there for a long time, and that maybe there's always been an audience there, and they just haven't been catered to.
So, why? I guess the question that would lead me to ask is, why is this book, Harley Quinn, succeeding where so many other similar attempts have failed?
I think it's hard to say for sure. I think that, for one thing, a consistent creative team from the time that it started.
It's been Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti.
And Jimmy Palmiotti, right. Yep. I think number two, not tied in to the greater universe as a whole. And I know that you and I have been talking about one of the things we love about Rebirth is how interconnected it all is. But quite frankly, you can pick up a Harley Quinn issue and not feel lost. I mean, I picked up one at the shop about 2 weeks ago when I was there, just thumbed through it, and I wasn't confused. I found it entertaining, and I think that's one of the big things for it is people, new readers, can pick it up and get into it, and it's a book that doesn't take itself seriously, and I think there's something to be said for that. And I don't know, it's a character in general in Harley Quinn that a lot of people, men, male and female alike, by the way, find a lot of enjoyment in, because she's kind of, a lot of people compare her to DC's Deadpool, and there are some similarities there, but why is Deadpool popular? Because he doesn't take himself seriously, because you'll see things in a Deadpool comic that you will not see in any other comic.
Right, but you also would never see a Deadpool comic moving 400,000 copies.
No, that's correct. And I think that that speaks to the female appeal, that speaks to a character that's popularity is,
I think it
has skyrocketed for years.
This is, I mean, the Harley Quinn thing right now is so huge, it's hard to imagine it getting any bigger. I kind of feel like we are seeing the crest, the high point of the Harley Quinn wave, so to speak. So,
and hopefully, and how many times have you heard me bitch and complain, Nick, about how there haven't been any A-list comic characters created in the last 20 years? Well, I have to say, and my hope, my God's honest hope here, is I think that Harley Quinn, of all people, could end up being that A-list character that joins the ranks of the Spider-Mans and the Batmans and the Wonder Womans and the X-Men as A-list characters, because if you can put together a few more months of selling north of 150,000 copies, I mean, it's going to be hard to deny that she's one of the most popular characters in all comics. It's reminiscent of Wolverine's surging popularity in the 80s. How Wolverine went from kind of an ancillary supporting character in X-Men to the most popular X-Man to, by the early 90s, the most popular Marvel character alongside Spider-Man. I think that we're seeing that with Harley, and it's pretty damn cool.
I agree completely.
Well, we're about to head to the break, depending on what I was about to say just then. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to have our lists. We want you to get your lists ready, ladies and gentlemen, and see how they match up with ours, because we're going to run through our definitive lists Nick's and mine of the top five comic book superhero film fight scenes. And we've got some classics on here. I'm sure we're going to leave some off. Let us know. But stay with us through the break, and we'll have those lists for you right after these messages.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
The big man is back.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for sticking around, all you loyal listeners out there. We, of course, again, are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we're here to bring you another sterling edition of Countdown. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, we're counting down the top five superhero movie fight scenes. Now, this covers a lot of ground. This covers decades and decades of superhero cinema. A few of the ground rules going into it, we were obviously limiting it to superhero movies. And again, excluding television. So stuff like Daredevil's hallway fight scene, not eligible. So it has to have been on the big screen, has to be a superhero movie. And we were limiting it to live action as well.
Yes.
So few of the ground rules. And what
about there haven't been that many theatrically released superhero animated movies anyway.
Right, so. Mask of the Phantasm,
Big Hero 6. I guess Killing Joke would technically count. Things of that sort.
Right, and did you have any criteria that you had in putting together your list, Nick? Any personal criteria of what makes a good superhero fight scene?
You know, I'm not nearly the hand-to-hand aficionado that you are, so my main thing was it had to be memorable. It had to have something, a moment, or maybe even, you know, some sort of impact on the rest of the movie that made it stick and made it, you know, just resonate with me. For the most part, in these, I mean, years after seeing it for the first time. Because that's one thing I can say is, for most of my list, is at least a few years old at this point, and the scenes I have chosen are all ones that I still remember vividly, almost every blow. So, yeah, for me, it was just that air of importance and that ability to just stick in my head.
Right. And for me, I think it came down to everybody's got their own criteria for what they like in an action scene. As you know, I'm a big, big action movie aficionado, and I think that I'm a little... Sometimes I've been accused of being hypercritical of action scenes in movies, and superhero movies in particular, but only because I feel like they should be held to a higher standard. Because if you're doing a superhero movie, you're making an action movie. And quite frankly, there are... Man, I'm turning into JR and Vince by the day with all the quite franklies. There are staples of the genre that should be looked at.
Genre.
Good Lord. Genre that should be looked at as examples of how to do it right. And I think that the keys to a good fight scene, and this is simplifying it, but it should be energetic. It should... within the confines and the rules of the universe that you've established in the film, it should be realistic. I don't mean realistic in terms of it could happen in real life. I mean within the whatever the ground rules are that you've set up, the physics that you've set up in your world, the fight should still look like it's a fight. And whether that's a Matrix world where you've got reality warping and all that stuff, it should still look like the two characters want to do one another harm. Number three, and most importantly, so I guess you would say number one, my number one criteria of any fight in a movie, in a TV show, in pro wrestling, it must tell a story. And that's the one... unifying factor that all five of the scenes that are on my list have. Each of them tells a story within the fight and or within the scene. And that was one of the hardest things about separating the top of the top here, because I don't know about you, Nick. I had about 8 to 10 scenes that I was kind of narrowing it down, and it was really hard, and a lot of it came down to just arbitrary, this is how I feel today versus this is how I felt last week. So that was kind of how it was for me, but all the ones that I picked told a story within the fight, seemed realistic, and had an energy about them.
Yeah, I had 6 that I had narrowed it down to that I felt really, really good about, and if we had done a top 6, I'd have been set. Making the decision over what to keep and what to drop, which one wasn't going to make it, was agonizing, because the one that just missed my list is a scene that I love so much, but, you know, didn't make the cut.
With all that being said, let's get things started, and I'll kick things off with my number 5 fight scene,
mm-hmm.
which comes from Captain America, the Winter Soldier, mm. and this is Captain America versus George Batroc, or Batroc the Leaper, if you're familiar with the comic books, portrayed by UFC legendary fighter, former welterweight champion Georges St-Pierre, and this made my list for a few reasons. Some may find it surprising that this one made the list instead of the Winter Soldier fight. But I had my reasons for that. And
one of them being your giant GSP mark.
Yes, that is an aspect, I'll admit. Quite frankly, I'll admit that. I'm a big GSP fan. But that's not the only reason. I found the Winter Soldier fight to be very good, but lacking a little in some of the middle of the fight. You know, there was some great stuff in there. I liked some of the usage of transitions and things like that, but there was just something about it that didn't feel as final as I hoped it would feel. But with this fight between Cap and Batroc, which happens near the very beginning of the Winter Soldier movie, you see for the first time, by the way, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you see a really well-choreographed hand-to-hand fight scene. Not relying on gimmicks, not relying on CGI, relying on damn good choreography, relying on damn good stunt work, and relying on two guys who aren't afraid to get a little rough in there. You see arm bars, you see single legs, you see hip tosses, you see the savant stylings that GSP is easily able to mimic of the character. And the whole thing comes off realistic. And I don't know this for a fact, but I have to believe that GSP had some kind of hand in choreographing this fight scene, and perhaps the Winter Soldier fight scene as well, because this comes off so much more believable and realistic and good action movie-y than any of the prior MCU fight scenes. It's a case where you get to see Captain America get down and dirty and brutal and show that when he can't rely on gimmickry, when he has to go, he can go. You know, he's a badass, a legitimate badass. And this is a chance to show that in action and to add a little bit of menace to a comic book character that's kind of corny. So really, job well done by the Russo brothers, and the first glimpse that we got that these Russo brothers were going to add a totally new action dynamic to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. More on that later.
Absolutely. I will say that I love Captain America the Winter Soldier. I love every fight scene in that movie. However, none of the fight scenes from that movie made my list.
Oh.
So, moving on to my number five. And I had – anytime we talk about the greatest anything in superhero movies, I am going to find a way to have the Holy Trilogy represented. And so at number five, I'm going with Bane versus Batman. One, the first encounter from The Dark Knight Rises, or as I like to call it, The Breaking of the Bat.
Yes, thank you. I am so glad you put this on your list, Nick, because this was one of the movies I mentioned that were on my chopping block that were very close to making it.
It is a brutal, brutal fight scene, and it almost represents the pinnacle of Chris Nolan evolving as a director of action, because one of the few complaints I can legitimately understand about Batman Begins is it's difficult to follow the action at times because very shaky cam, very Bourne influenced, it feels like, and it's just not done very well. They took a step forward with The Dark Knight, and I can say they had adequate fight scenes in The Dark Knight, but just adequate. This one, however, is an outstanding fight scene. It is brutal, it is visceral, and it is unflinching in its portrayal of the ass whooping that Batman has to take.
And appropriately so, because it was trying to tell a story and encapsulate one of the most iconic battles in all of Batman lore, where he got his ass kicked. And if anything, the comic book version's even more lopsided in some ways.
Yes. And one thing, one of the superhero tropes one of the conventions of the genre is the monologue, the evil monologue that the villain has to give during the fight. And I thought this one actually made sense in the context of the fight. Tom Hardy delivers it well. And the moves they pull out are just, they're just great moves, man. I mean, like, you see Batman getting desperate by turning to theatricality and deception, as Bane calls it. And then when we finally, you know, it builds and it builds to this crescendo, and it finally comes, the big, he picks him up, breaks him over his knee, man, and it's just an outstanding image. But even more so than that, I remember, I think the moment of that fight that sticks out to me more than anything else is when Bane has him down and is just punching him repeatedly in the head, and you can see the cowl cracking around him because his head is just slamming into this concrete slab that he's sitting there on, and you can just hear this sickening thud of Bane just pounding him into submission. And one thing that sells this fight very well is Anne Hathaway actually looking on and the horror on her face as Bane just destroys Batman in brutal fashion just gets over to another degree the story that Nolan was trying to convey with this fight scene. So Bane Breaks the Bat is my number 5. Wouldn't have it any other way.
Outstanding. And I will just say that one of the other aspects that I loved about that fight scene, again, told a story, a great story, the story being that Batman, for the first time in his life, is completely outmatched, and or for the first time in his tenure as Batman, anyway, is completely outmatched. And the other thing I liked about it was no music, the sound effects. The sound effects in that scene, I vividly remember because watching the film for the first time, it just, you felt Bruce Wayne's pain when he was being beaten down by Bane. It was so hard-hitting and unapologetic and unflinching, and the sound editing was just tremendous. You could feel it in the theater. Every grunt, every bone breaking, just a phenomenal, phenomenal piece of work. So, I totally agree. It's the shining fight scene, certainly, of the Nolan trilogy. Maybe the shining action scene of the Nolan trilogy. That leads into my number 4 pick. And man, this was a hard one to pare down because I had 2 scenes from the same movie that I was choosing between to get on here, and honestly, both of them probably should have made my list, but I went with this one, and I'll explain why in just a moment. And the one that I went with, the movie I'm referring to, X2, X-Men United, the one that I went with is Wolverine at the Mansion, the raid on the mansion by William Stryker's troops. And this is the first time, well, not the first time, because the first X-Men movie, as we talked about on this podcast not too long ago, had some really cool Wolverine moments in it, some cool Wolverine action movies, or action scenes, I should say. But this was the first time we really got to see Wolverine cut loose. Yep. Would you not agree?
Oh, yeah, totally. Because he didn't have enough nameless, faceless bodies to plow through in the first X-Men movie.
Exactly.
Here they gave him a row of soldiers that just lined up for their ass whooping, much like the entire Alliance lined up to take a stunner.
Lined up to get their stunners.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah, the overwhelming lesson I feel like of X2 is don't try to invade Wolverine's house, wherever it may be, because William Stryker and his troops had better days.
Much better days.
You get the stealth claws through the back. You get the berserker rampage where he's just chopping guys down left and right, cutting them down with his claws. Taking him out. And then one of my favorite parts of the entire scene, which I went back and watched today, when he stabs the guy through the foot as he's trying to sneak around the corner. Outstanding. Incredible scene. And again, the first time you get to see my favorite X-Men character unleash on the big screen, had to make the list. The other deciding factor, I was choosing from another scene that I think is probably going to make your list, if I can remember correctly here.
That's cheating, Greg, and you know it.
But the deciding factor was the Nightcrawler opening sequence, which we have repeatedly called the greatest opening sequence in superhero movie history. An outstanding scene, but to me it wasn't as much of a fight as this Wolverine scene was. Like the Nightcrawler scene is so fast and so one-sided, which the Wolverine scene's one-sided too, but they do shoot him, they do get in some licks. That gave it a very slight edge, but honestly I could go either way on it. But ultimately, this Wolverine at the mansion scene is indicative of one of the many reasons why X2 is to this day one of the greatest superhero movies ever made, and that's still to this day one of the greatest superhero action scenes ever made.
I agree. I very much wanted to put it on my list. It was an agonizing cut, and in a apropos, parallel here, my number four from X2 is Nightcrawler assaulting the White House in the opening.
Absolutely.
I would classify it as a fight. It's a room full of Secret Service agents that are foolishly attempting to stop Nightcrawler. And I think the reason why this one makes my list, it tells the story of just humanity being completely helpless to stop mutant kind when they are hell-bent on, accomplishing a mission. And also, it gave us something that we had never really seen in superhero movies or even in action movies before, the constant teleportation. It just brought a whole new level to that scene that we haven't seen before and probably, well, not even probably, hasn't been done as well since. Still stands
up. Do you remember the first time you saw it?
Oh, my God, yeah.
It was at the movie theater when I was watching this movie for the first time. My friends and I, our jaws were literally hanging open as the scene happened.
Right.
We were looking at each other like, oh my God, this is
right.
It just blew your mind.
Yeah, because I'm a little bit higher on the first X-Men movie than you are. And so I went into X2 thinking, all right, if this is as good as the first one, then we'll be set. And from the jump, that scene sets a tone where it surpasses anything they put on film in the first one in the first 6 minutes of the movie and doesn't let up from there. It is the perfect plate setter for what that movie winds up being.
And talk about a scene that holds up years later.
Oh, the special effects do not look, they don't look outdated, which happens so often with a lot of these. It still holds up, mainly because, they didn't try to CGI too much of Nightcrawler. I believe the tail was CGI, but the rest of him was practical effects, so that you can pretty much do that scene. I believe they did it with a lot of wire work, and the only CGI you had to use was for the actual bamfing, the blue smoke or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very well done scene. And it's weird because most of the time in fight scenes, you want to see every blow. But I think one of the most effective moments of that scene is when it cuts to the outside of the door and they're holding that shot on the door and you hear what's going on in the inside. You can almost, mm-hmm. Your mind's eye creates this comic book panel where you're seeing Nightcrawler just destroy these guys in brutal, brutal fashion. So I love this scene to this day. I was much like you. I was torn over which X2 scene was going to make my list, and this is the one I ultimately settled on.
And I completely understand why. It's the greatest opening scene I can think of. Just phenomenal. And holds up well to this day. But from a scene that showcases superpowers to a scene that focuses more on being just as gritty and as visceral and as violent as any that you've seen in a superhero movie, my number three pick for my top five list is The Comedian versus Ozymandias from Watchmen. This is the
another
classic
opening scene.
Yes.
Not technically. This is the opening scene in the movie, yeah.
An opening scene, yes. And this is that classic opening with the Nat King Cole song Unforgettable playing in the background, where it's almost this operatic scene playing out before you as you see Ozymandias, who we don't know as Ozymandias at the time unless you've read the story, come into the hotel room or the apartment, rather, and comedian fights with everything he's got. He tries for the gun. He tries for any weapon he can find. And Ozymandias just beats the ever-loving life out of the comedian, literally, to the point where he finishes by throwing the comedian out the window, where you see the classic comedian badge with the blood drip on it that sets up the entire story going forward. This is one that I would recommend anybody out there go on YouTube right now and see if you can find the scene on there, because it, even those of you that don't like Watchmen, the movie, I don't see how you could not like this scene, because this scene is emotional. It's moving. It perhaps because of the music and the lighting, it just brings out a certain mood, and it sets up the story to play out and the ultimate tragedy of everything. And in the process gives you every punch, every kick, every knee just feels like it connects. It feels like this could have been a Hong Kong fight scene. Absolutely. Like, not, you know, just gritty old boy style violence.
Yeah, this is a great scene. Didn't make my cut, but you mentioned the lighting. I want to say this. A lot of people rag on Zack Snyder as a director, and he has earned some of that ire, I think. But I think the one thing you can never disagree with is he knows how to direct an action scene. And specifically from a lighting standpoint, think about how difficult it must have been to put together such a dynamic action scene without being able to show one of the two combatants' faces throughout the entire fight. That is a masterstroke of placement, direction, and choreography that is still amazing to me to this day.
Absolutely. And again, to my number one criterion for any fight scene, it tells a beautiful story, because by a combination of the acting, the stunt work, the choreography, the lighting, the sound, the overall directing from Zack Snyder, it puts across just the desperation of the comedian to survive, because it's apparent from the get-go that he knows how serious this situation is. And then finally, the utter futility as he realizes that no matter what he does, he's thoroughly outclassed and this is the end of the road for him. That tale of desperation giving way to acceptance is just beautifully done in this fight scene.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And now for a somewhat controversial selection at my number three spot. From one Zack Snyder joint to another, I'm going with Superman versus Zod from Man of Steel.
Oh, at number very three. Good. Interesting.
And the reason is very simple. They finally let us have a Superman action scene in the movies. Which sounds like a dumb thing to say, but consider that in Superman Returns, the only thing he fights is a giant kryptonite rock.
Which he inexplicably is able to lift into the heavens.
And then fall back to Earth in a Christ pose. But anyway,
right.
Finally, after years of begging for it, they used modern technology to present a fully realized version of what a Superman fight scene could be on the big screen. Does it go on too long? Yeah, probably. Is it gratuitous and over the top in its violent 9/11 evoking imagery? Of course. But yet, I love it anyway, because we'd been begging for it. And it's almost like they said, all right, you've waited for 40 years. Here's 40 years worth of Superman fight scene crammed into one.
Yep.
And it delivers, in my opinion.
Yep.
Absolutely delivers. It is...
The heat vision, the super speed effects,
yes,
through the air, the rapid fire punches,
yes,
the
Zod, almost like a gorilla, like running up the building towards Superman. There are so many just really cool moments in this thing.
My favorite part, although they probably overdid it, but hell, I I'm not going to complain because I've wanted to see it in a movie since I was 8 years old. The scene where Superman and an opponent punch each other at the same time and the force of the punches causes the glass in the buildings nearby to break.
Yes. Absolutely. There were so many great things. Even had a little levity thrown in there where they're fighting at a construction site and you see the sign in the background that says 100-something days since the last injury and Superman gets thrown into it and it resets to zero. just a great little nod there. The moment where Zod picks up the steel beam and is going to hit him with it and Superman in mid-swing melts it to slag using his heat vision. There are so many cool moments in this fight scene. And like I said, it is something we've been waiting for, something we've been begging for so many years, that when we finally got it, I'm not going to complain when they gave us too much of it. Like, that was a good thing, in my opinion. We needed some of that. And yes, I understand the ending of this fight is somewhat unique and somewhat controversial. That's never bugged me as much as it has a lot of people. But the fight itself is just great. And, like you said, it tells a story. And I thought Michael Shannon in this scene was great at selling the frustration and desperation and loss that the character of Zod felt at that point, where he didn't care what happened from then on because he had literally nothing left to live for. His entire reason for being had been taken away from him by Superman, and he was going to do whatever it took to hurt him just as bad as he had been hurt. So I love this scene for so many reasons, and I really loved in Batman v Superman getting to see it play out from a different perspective, a more visceral, ground-level perspective. So,
yeah, and I thought that the movie also did a good job of telling the story that Zod had so much more experience than Clark, and it's that experience that allows him to basically dominate the fight.
Right.
He controls probably 70% of the fight. And, again, that's really good continuity, and that's really good storytelling. But mainly, it was just badass to see Superman get to use his freaking powers to the full extent of their abilities, besides, you know, spinning around and digging a hole in the ground or something, you know?
Well, getting shot in the eye by a bullet.
Right. Which was a cool scene, admit.
Which was a cool scene, but that was like
the extent
of
it, yeah.
That was like the high point of the action in Superman Returns.
Yes, that's true.
So.
On to my number two. We mentioned earlier how X2 blew our minds when we saw it in the theater. The action scenes set a what was then a new bar. We had never seen anything like it. But they were short and punchy action scenes. You know, the Nightcrawler sequence lasts, what, maybe, Nick, would you say maybe minute and a half? Minute?
Yeah, maybe a little longer than that, but it's not,
maybe
they're
two
not
minutes,
overly
not long.
Yeah,
yeah, the mansion scene is right at about 3 minutes long. But the next year after X2 was released, a movie came out that set the new bar for epic fight scenes, for the Superman Zod kind of fight scene that is going to be a long, drawn out, epic, up and down, take you on an emotional roller coaster ride fight scene. And the scene that I'm referring to is from Spider-Man 2. And it's Spider-Man versus Doc Ock. Starts at a clock tower, ends up on a train, and that classic train action sequence where Spidey is fighting Doc Ock while trying to stop this speeding runaway train, while trying to save bystanders that Doc Ock is putting in danger.
And trying to protect his identity all at the same time.
And trying to protect his identity all at the same time. It is, in my opinion, Sam Raimi's greatest moment. It is one of the best. I actually went back today and watched it for the first time in a long time, just that scene. And it's one of the best directed action scenes of the 2000s, in my opinion. That's high praise, but I believe that. I think that it is a masterpiece of epic, operatic, superhero storytelling. Because what's the complaint that you see in some of these modern superhero movies? Well, oh, you didn't see Superman save people while he was fighting Zod, which I've always thought was a corny complaint, but whatever. I get it. Oh, you don't see the Avengers saving enough people while they're fighting the Chitauri. Okay, whatever. I get it.
That's also blatantly not true.
Right. but... this this is how you do it. Like, this is like you see Spider-Man in the midst of his identity being in danger, his life being in danger, risking it all to save other people first, and then to fight his enemy second. And it's just a masterpiece. It's epic from beginning to end, tells an amazing story. He sacrifices everything to save the people on the train, and damn it, at the end of it, if they don't repay his sacrifice. It's just wonderful. The CGI holds up very well to this day. You know, you can tell it's CGI, but it holds up better than a lot of the movies that came even in recent years. Really good acting, really good choreography, outstanding choreography in this scene. And just as important, tells this wonderful story of sacrifice, of back and forth advantages, but just as important, it is the only time in my entire life that I have ever viewed Dr. Octopus as a legitimate, non-laughable villain.
Wow.
True story, because every time I read him in the comics, every time I saw him on the cartoon, I thought, okay, I'm going to skip this issue. I'm going to skip this episode, because everything from his haircut to his stupid glasses to his stupid uniform that he wore, I never found him a compelling character until this movie with Alfred Molina's performance. But this scene in particular, they did so much to maximize his tentacles, his arms, essentially, that from that moment forward, I was like, you know what? Doc Ock is a legitimate villain now. So I can't say enough about this scene. I think it's a testament to that series, and I feel like it's unfortunate that that movie doesn't get talked about as much now as it used to, because that scene is so important for what came later, because movies have used that, I think, as the template for what to do and how to do a good action scene in a superhero movie.
I agree. It's a great scene. Did not make my list, but I certainly understand all the reasons for it making yours. Moving on to my number two, you know, I talked a few minutes ago about how the reason I love that, or one of the reasons I love that Superman Zod fight so much is because I had been waiting for it, waiting to see something like it for so long. And my number two is on my list for much the same reason. And my number two is, of course, the Avengers versus the Chitauri, the closing action scene from the event, Marvel's The Avengers. And the reason it makes my list is, to that point, we had been waiting a little over 4 years. We had sat through, what, four movies to that point? Iron Man 2, Captain America, Thor. Yeah, five movies, and The Incredible Hulk. Five movies of build, and we get to The Avengers, and they smartly hold off on putting the team together in an action scene until the end of the movie. And when it finally happens, when the Avengers are finally standing there together in that pose of battle where the camera pans around them, you can't help but, like, almost cheer the first time you see it. And throw in the fact that this is a fight scene where every character gets a moment to shine. Every character gets a badass moment, whether it's Hawkeye blindly firing arrows over his shoulder and making perfect headshots, or Black Widow doing somersaults up into the air and landing on hoverboards to take out a Chitauri, or whether it's, you know, the Hulk going absolutely berserk and smashing Chitauri into the side of buildings, or Thor running around and doing awesome Thor things, whether it's Iron Man taking down the big Leviathan with his Jonah and the Whale parable, or Captain America and Iron Man working together. It is just an amazing, amazing scene from start to finish. One that still, you know, gets me excited every time I watch it, like it's the first time all over again. It's a fairly one-sided fight. You don't see the Avengers take very many blows here, but that doesn't stop it from being incredibly satisfying in so many ways. So for all those reasons, for the way it made me feel as a comic book fan, and for the way it still makes me feel whenever I see it, that makes my list at number two.
Yeah, absolutely. It's... To this day, I think, I don't know if you would agree, probably my favorite usage of the Hulk in any movie to this point.
I really like the Hulkbuster versus Hulk sequence from Age of Ultron, but
true.
This would be up there, yes.
But this was the first time we've really gotten to see the Hulk unleash in a way that didn't have kind of mediocre CGI, and it worked. It just worked. I will say it didn't make my list primarily because I don't think the fight itself told much of a story, but it was awesome regardless, and I had a childlike sense of wonder when I watched it, which is all you can ask out of these movies. The same thing that you and I say about Age of Ultron. It just gave us that childlike sense of wonder, and holds up every time you watch it. It's got these iconic moments that we've been waiting to see since we were little kids.
Absolutely.
Which, speaking of which, brings me to my number one. And speaking of the Avengers, more specifically, speaking of Captain America and Iron Man, my scene comes from 2016, and it comes from Captain America, Civil War, my number one comic book superhero fight scene of all time. And I said this when I left the theater. Team Cap versus Team Iron Man at the airport.
That's my painting.
I had a feeling that we would both have this at number one.
Yeah, absolutely. This also is my number one. Nothing like it has been attempted or
achieved.
Or achieved. And I feel... I am preemptively saddened by the idea that DC is going to attempt their version of it at some point, and they are not going to execute it as well. I am already sad about that, because this is as perfect a representation of that old comic book trope of hero versus hero battle that you are going to see. It's almost flawless in its execution.
Yeah, everything from serious emotional stakes with Iron Man and Cap and the dissolution of their friendship before your very eyes, to quippy one-liners as particularly Spider-Man provides in the fight, you know, to almost sub-fights within the fight where you get Hawkeye versus the Black Widow and all of their history with each other.
And a brilliant piece of storytelling where it is never stated directly, but it is heavily implied that neither of them are actually trying to hurt the other.
Yeah.
I mean, just a brilliant piece of storytelling within that fight where that is one showdown between those two characters where they aren't willing to take it as far as Tony and Cap are, clearly.
Yep. You get, you know, obviously Cap and Tony, but you get Spider-Man versus the Winter Soldier and the Falcon, which the Winter Soldier and the Falcon had one of my favorite dynamics in the movie anyway, but that interaction as Spider-Man is quipping to them the whole time that he's basically kicking their butts.
And how awesome is it that they put Spider-Man over, to use a wrestling term, by having him not only hold his own, but like you said, pretty much dominate both the Winter Soldier and the Falcon at the same time throughout the fight.
And then, of course, we get the big the Falcon calls in his little drone buddy, Vanguard One, as I'll call him now, and he helps him out. And then, of course, Winter Soldier has the line, maybe lead with that next time. I think that was Winter Soldier's line. But yeah, just an outstanding scene from beginning to end. Finally, getting to see Giant Man on the big screen.
But even before that, Ant-Man on the tip of Hawkeye's arrow.
Of Hawkeye's arrow, which is the classic comic book moment brought to life. The creation of Giant Man. I was a big sucker. You know, maybe you don't know this about me, I don't know, but I've been a big War Machine advocate since I was a kid. I always thought they should have done more with War Machine. So to finally see War Machine, for what felt like the first time, really get to unload his arsenal was awesome. Because
really the only other time he had done that was the closing scene of Iron Man 2, which I think we can both agree is a fairly subpar
Yes.
I mean, the fight he's in lasts all of, like, 90 seconds, you know?
Yeah. And so this was War Machine getting to show his entire arsenal off and show, you know, the shoulder cannons and the things that make him cool and that made him cool to me when I was a kid. So for me personally, it was awesome to see War Machine get a moment like that. Everybody gets a moment to shine. The Vision gets a badass moment.
Oh.
Scarlet Witch, badass moments. Cap, badass moment. Spider-Man, badass moments. Everybody in the fight gets a badass moment. Even Ant-Man gets badass moments. Just a flawless piece of work. A comic book fight scene brought to life. And that's the biggest compliment I could
pick. Another small thing I want to call out, not even really about the fight itself, but more so from a scene perspective, that just encapsulates the character of Captain America when... I can't remember exactly when it happens. I think it's during the fight, and he says something to Spider-Man, like, "Where are you from, kid?" And he says, "Queens." And he goes, "Oh, Brooklyn." And, like, it's this really just, like, it's such a Captain America thing to do, you know?
And, like we've said
It fits in with that. Everything in that movie just fits. Like, nothing feels out of step, which is amazing given how many moving parts there are going on in that scene and throughout the rest of that movie.
It speaks to the quaintness of Chris Evans' Captain America, how the word that we've used in the past is earnest. Like, so if that scene were written in a comic, you might say, "Oh, there's cheesy Captain America again." But when you see it in the movie, you just like him.
Yep.
You know that it's genuine. It's not him being condescending. It's or him, you know, being fake. He's 100% serious about what he's saying. And he's like, "Oh, cool." You know, he's actually having a moment there. And the everybody plays their role to perfection. The CGI is outstanding. The pacing is wonderful. Can't say enough about that scene. I am confident in saying it's the best superhero fight scene that I've ever seen. And do you have anything else to add about it?
No, man. It's outstanding. I actually that scene – well, not just that scene, but – that scene contributed heavily to me breaking with my tradition of not buying the MCU movies as individual standalones. I tend to try to wait for the big box sets they do. But I actually bought Civil War over the weekend just because I wanted to rewatch that scene and all of the Spider-Man stuff especially. Civil War was such an amazing accomplishment to a degree that I don't think even me as somebody who's a fan of the comic book storyline was expecting it to succeed in the way that it did. From a storytelling standpoint, anyway. So, and that scene, like you said, is just a great representation of how good that movie is. I mean, Civil War, in many ways, might be, to this point anyway, like the ultimate evolution of what these Marvel movies are supposed to be. And that scene shows it because it's the best superhero fight scene of all time.
You know, a lot of us, you know, the complaints that people have about the Marvel Cinematic Universe that we've talked about before, where even earlier on the show we talked about some of the villains. The villains tend to be pretty milquetoast villains. But then one of the other complaints that I and other people have had is that the action scenes in Marvel Cinematic Universe movies have not been very inventive or very creative. This threw that out the window.
And you have got at least four that I can think of off the top of my head. At least four standout action scenes in this movie, whether it's the Cap and Winter Soldier escaping the cop scene in the stairwell, or whether it's the Black Panther chasing down the Winter Soldier on foot, which was amazing. This scene, and then, of course, the big... one-on-one Cap and Tony and Winter Soldier. Cap and Winter Soldier versus Tony battle at the end. I mean, those four scenes, if we were doing a top five Marvel Cinematic Universe fight scenes, this movie alone would probably have two or three of the top five, I would think.
I would agree. And you know, that brings an end to our countdown, and I would challenge everybody out there to, if you get a chance, go on YouTube, go through your DVD collection, whatever it takes, watch these fight scenes and examine them and see how they tell a story and see how they're constructed in a way that is creative and that would stand alongside really good genre films, action genre films. And if you've got some that we missed, because there was a ton
that we had
to cut down from.
Yep.
And if you've got any that we've missed or that we might have forgotten about, I've already seen some people on Twitter bring up some, and I'd actually like to talk about some of those in a moment that people have mentioned on Twitter that didn't make our lists, some that I had forgotten about or had never seen. But I did want to say that for me, dead last, the bottom of the list of superhero fight scenes, Hulk versus the dogs from Ang Lee's Hulk.
Oh man, we're gonna have to go off the page with Ang Lee's Hulk at some point.
Bad, so bad.
Well, I will say if you're gonna pick apart a fight scene from that movie, at least in that fight scene, you can see what is going on with Hulk and the dogs. I have seen that Hulk versus the Absorbing Man final battle from that movie at least 3 times, and I can't follow a single second of it ever.
It really doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense, and they almost like try to do it in a series of still images at a certain point, like up against the lightning or whatever, and it just – you can't follow it at all. But that's another topic for another day.
I posed the question to Twitter of what are some of the the oft-forgotten superhero fight scenes or some that should make our lists, and got some feedback from various people. Russell Sellers, some may have heard of him, some feller that has occasionally contributed to Place to Be Nation Pop every few weeks with Sellers Points podcast. He suggested the Night Owl and Silk Spectre prison rescue in Watchmen.
That's a good one. That's a great one.
Absolutely. One that I had forgotten about until he mentioned it, but I went back and watched that, and it's really, really good. Adam Langton mentioned Blade from the first Blade movie as he marches toward Deacon Frost, killing minions without even looking at them. Again, went back and watched that. Incredibly well done. And he also mentioned Blade 2 when he rises from the pool of blood and ends the fight with a stalling vertical suplex. It also reminded me that the Blade series had a lot of awesome action scenes.
Right.
Often forgotten. Captain America in the elevator.
Definitely.
Winter Soldier.
From Winter Soldier, yeah.
Yep. Let's see what some of these other suggestions were. Our friend Glennie of the Glenn Butler Podcast Spectacular, Clark Kent versus Superman from Superman 3, which I'm a big fan of.
Of course he did. Of course. Of course. Leave it to Glenn Butler to fit in the Superman 3 whenever the opportunity presents itself.
That's right. And I am a big fan of that one, actually. That's a scene that holds up to this day, although I maintain that evil Superman should have won the fight. Outstanding. He also mentioned that. Here's one that also caught me off guard because I haven't had a chance to watch this. We will be watching it in a few months, though. Incredible Hulk running through the streets and alleys of Rio.
Ooh, now is that a fight scene, though?
That's a question because I haven't watched it in so long I can't remember what he did in that scene. Also, Ant-Man's train set fight.
Actually, yeah. That's a great choice, and it's a great choice because it flips so many of the conventions of not just the genre but more specifically the Marvel Cinematic Universe on its head, and really takes it from where you're used to these giant epic universe shattering battles, and this takes place in a child's bedroom. I mean, and the specific scene where they pull out and the train just kind of feebly runs off the tracks, and that's about all the damage that's being caused
yes.
as a result. That's
yep.
actually really well. That's a great outside the box choice. Yeah.
Yep. Creative. Now here's one from a movie that I haven't seen in years, so I can't really remember the scene itself. I don't know if you've ever seen it. One of our listeners, Marco Lazic, suggested The Crow, the scene in which he takes on all the gangsters in the club upstairs. I need to rewatch The Crow would make for
I haven't seen The Crow in
page.
A long time.
Yeah,
it's
same
been
here.
Many
I,
years.
Legitimately, probably 10 years for me. And I need to watch.
Longer for me. I would imagine probably not since around. Man, I saw it a couple times when Sting first started doing The Crow thing. I think I've seen it since like 99, probably.
So we should do an off the page on that at some point. Should be
at
interesting. And he also suggests Wolverine versus Deathstrike in X2.
That's a good one.
Very good.
I think I like the other two.
I agree.
That we talked about better, but I think that's a very good one.
But that's certainly worthy of consideration. And again, taking a character in Lady Deathstrike that would be very easy to screw up and not screwing her up. So that was good. Absolutely. And for nostalgia's sake, he threw out the Ninja Turtles versus Shredder from the first Ninja Turtles movie.
You know, that's actually not a – that's a pretty good fight scene,
yeah,
given the limitations they had to work with those giant
pad suits, yeah.
Well, no, it was the giant, you know, Muppets that they were essentially working with, because Jim Henson Creature Shop built those things. And so working around those, given what was a limited budget, especially towards the end of that production, if you've ever read up anything on the making of that movie, that's a pretty good choice. That was as good a fight scene as they were going to be able to produce, given the limitations they had to work with. I'll say that much. Now, of course, it would be topped in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, which was, of course, the highest grossing action
movie
film of all time.
Of all time, right.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, you got the charts. If you look at the charts, you got No Holds Barred, which, you know, it made a little money here and there and there. And you got The Lonesome Dove, made for TV movies. Not too bad. You got a couple things like The Condemned or whatever, and that's a thing. And you got Walking Tall and the Fast and the Furious series. They're decent, but Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze, chart goes through the roof. The chart doesn't even hold the bar at a certain point.
That's right. And that's not even counting the 2004 Punisher movie. That's a whole different chart.
That's a whole other chart. And plus, you got to remember that those two movies, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 and The Punisher, are both charted in Canadian dollars as opposed to American dollars.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, it's probably even more than that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. And then finally, I had at least two people, possibly three, mention to me the scene of Batman rescuing Martha at the end of Batman versus Superman.
Especially if you're pulling from the Ultimate Edition. Yeah, I can see that.
Yep. So
I think that's the big disappointment of that movie is that Batman versus Superman isn't even the best fight scene in that movie. Like,
that's a great point.
It's legitimately not, and it should, like, what when it after it was over, you're kind of like, well, that's it.
The best fight scenes in that movie were Batman versus regular people.
I for one am stunned that no one thought to name Daredevil versus Elektra on the playground from Daredevil.
Was it Evanescence that was playing in that scene? I can't remember.
Wasn't Evanescence? My memory of that movie is that Evanescence was playing in every
scene. That's how I remember it. I'm sure it's not like that, but I remember Evanescence song.
Wake me up inside.
Wake me up, yeah. Which now I'm thinking about Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go from Deadpool. But
so now we're faced with the dilemma, Greg, as we play off for this episode. Are we going to hear Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, or are we going to hear Wake Me Up Inside?
Or are we going to get a Todd Weber-created mashup of the two a la WWE tag teams? the Jera Show theme song.
At this point, we have veered in the territory that is funny to only you and I.
Yes.
Discussions of charts, movies starring wrestlers, and now Evanescence Go-Go's matchups.
Oh, Lord Almighty. But I mentioned those Twitter mentions for the reason that follows. Contact us on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. And go to facebook.com. Look up Place to Be Nation Comics. It's an outstanding page. Come on there. Let us know what you think about the podcast. And give us your lists. That's what we're looking for here. We want you to send us your lists, and I'll read them on the air. I have no problem filling airtime reading your lists out and praising them or possibly mocking them. If you really like the Hulk versus Dogs fight scene, for instance. But let us know, get in contact with us. We want this to be an interactive show. So let us know what you think are the best superhero movie fight scenes, or even some that maybe wouldn't crack your top five, but some that are outside the box that we haven't talked about or that might be under people's radar a little bit. With all that being said, what do we have coming people's way next week, Nick?
Next week we have the long-awaited, much-anticipated, second biennial Peter David Memorial Place to Be Nation Pop Fantasy Comics Draft, presented by a hypothetical DC Comics Online Unlimited subscription service. We have the draft itself going up next week, and hopefully on the same day, the podcast that will cover our fantasy comics pitches. We will have over six hours of audio content for you next week. Dear Lord.
You know, speaking of 6 hours, I used to wrestle for 6 hours in a week.
Well, thanks, Stu. Nobody cares. We got it the first time. Stupid son of a bitch. Now, quite frankly, some might say that the best move for you as a listener to do would be to skip the draft podcast altogether and go straight to the pitches. That's just what some might say, though.
That's just what some might say. I think there is some train wreck-esque value in the draft. If you want to hear exasperation, I think is the best term for it from some individuals who participate, then I would recommend listening for that. Anyway, moving on.
Suffice it to say, the Place to Be Nation wellness policy will not be in effect for that episode.
Not be in effect in the least. Moving on from that, coming up in the month of October, as we have discussed in the past, it is going to be an entire month of Walking Dead-themed shows. We've got an off-the-page focusing on we're going to go back to the very beginning and look at the very first episode of The Walking Dead, the Walking Dead pilot from season one. We have got a Long Book Hunters on volumes 1 and 2, the first two trade paperbacks from the Walking Dead comic series. And then we have a countdown of our top 5 Walking Dead characters. And of course, wrapping it up at the end of the month, a full length review of the season premiere of season 7 of The Walking Dead on AMC. So, those are your Walking Dead shows coming up in the month of October. Hope you enjoy those. And then we'll be back to our normal schedule in November, and we'll have more information on that as we get closer.
And speaking of The Walking Dead, for Walking Dead Month, we're trying desperately, to get Larry King to guest star on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I've reached out to his representatives. Thus far, I've been told he does not understand what I'm referring to and doesn't appreciate being referred to as Walking Dead. So I'll keep everybody updated on how that will go. He would certainly be one of the biggest guests we've had since Gerard Depardieu. Would you not agree, Nick?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. You know, speaking of guests, don't forget, next week on the old draft podcast, Mel Kiper Jr. himself makes a brief appearance. So
he does. ESPN draft expert Mel Kiper Jr. Who knew that he even read comics?
Well, anytime, wherever there's a draft, Mel Kiper is standing by, ready to give his thoughts.
Ready to give his thoughts, whether you want them or not.
Whether you want them or not, including, I'm sure at some point there will be a, what?
Oh, Lord. Two game, by the way, we haven't given people what we promised them, a fantasy football update.
Oh, God.
I am currently sitting at 0-2, so my season's off to a rousing start. Thanks, Russell Wilson. And the entirety of the Chicago Bears.
I'm currently 1-1. I had a rough debut in week one, but week two went considerably better thanks to Isaiah Crowell of all people. And
your favorite player.
Oh yes, good old Isaiah. And some other guys that came through for me. And truly, I mean, I think last week my week two matchup featured the greatest starting quarterback battle in fantasy football history, as Jameis Winston took on Blake Bortles, and they each put up stellar performances. You know,
oh man,
so thrilling stuff to see a whopping 6 fantasy points put up by both starting quarterbacks.
Yes, I knew I made this mistake, and I even said it in the chat when we made the draft. I drafted Ryan Matthews. And I swore to myself 2 years ago I would never draft Ryan Matthews again. I made the mistake, and now I'm wallowing. He actually had a good game, but you know they've decided that Darren Sproles needs 30 carries a game. So,
you know who I should have started at quarterback who had a really good fantasy game?
Who's that?
Ryan Tannehill.
We're not going to talk about the Miami Dolphins. What we're going to do right now, folks, is sign off for the week, and we will be back with a fantasy football update that I'm sure you're all really fascinated by. And we'll have that for you next week.
We'll have that in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, two weeks. That's right. We're going to have
that's one thing we'll have to remind. That's one thing we should probably say. You know, there won't be any reading and watching next week. Nope. No rundown. So we'll have oversized editions of those on the first episode of October, because our two episodes, our draft episodes for next week, have been in the can for quite some time.
That's right. And it gives us a chance to relax. Instead of going to Vancouver, we're going to Waikiki for the week.
And actually, Greg, I just remembered, our draft podcast, if you listen to it, you will get to flash back to what were truly the best of times, an era in which the Ho-Ho Loon ticker still lived.
We don't mean to artificially inflate your hopes, your ho-hopes, folks, but it's just going to be a nice glimpse into a time when we were all happier. Ho-Ho Loon lives again, right here. On the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Don't you dare miss it.